Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next, a dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
On What's Next, we're going to talk about issues related to our job force here in Western New York and some of the challenges that workforce faces. With us, Tom Ulbrich, President and CEO of Goodwill of Western New York. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me. Appreciate you inviting us in.
Well, it's interesting. You've put out this brief from the Good Skills Career Builder program that you guys run, and it's all about transportation and the transportation challenges of the workforce here in Western New York. Interesting, lots of interesting elements in it. The first and foremost, just what is the challenge for somebody who doesn't have a car in Western New York when it comes to their careers?
Yeah, so I a lot has to do with where you're located,
sure.
Right? But ultimately, the individuals that we serve and we work with are traditionally unemployed or underemployed, and many in the cities of Buffalo, City of Niagara Falls, Jamestown. So in those instances, which a lot of this paper is focused on, it is a massive challenge, and as the report showed, it actually really disenfranchises someone at some level without, you know, coming up with some type of solution for many of these transportation problems. It impacts the level of, you know, the amount of people that remain in poverty. It actually impacts the dollars that somebody makes. The report showed that someone without a car in Buffalo is earning an average of over $20,000 less than somebody with a car. So in many, many different instances, it is a challenge. There's no question. And it's a persistent challenge. It's not something that is new. It's something that has been ongoing. And the reason we did this paper is it's a challenge that over 55% of the people that we work with, we address transportation challenges. So we wanted to bring this to the forefront, and we didn't want to focus on infrastructure. There's lots of individuals in our community that are expert planners, right, that do that type of work. And I trust that type of work is being done by the right people, but some of those solutions may take 10, 15 years to implement, where we were looking at some immediate needs. So we brought together employers to look at that.
And I wanted to get into that element of, because the other part of this that we've heard quite a bit about is there are jobs or possible jobs, great opportunities, companies that are looking to expand, but cannot find trained workers, or can't, in this case, shows that some of the trained workers or potentially trained workers couldn't get to the job.
No, absolutely. And that was the genesis of this report, is always hearing those stories out there of what you just spoke about, right? There's stories about employers with jobs, and here we're saying, well, we have people ready to work, but they're not able to connect with each other. And this was an issue that we believed was at sort of the core of a lot of it, which it ended up being. It certainly shows, this paper certainly shows, that transportation is one of those challenges, not being able to make the match. We also have a challenge in our community, especially in manufacturing, the graying of the workforce, so to speak.
Okay.
And over the next, you know, decade or so, there's numbers that float around where we're going to need 20,000 people in, you know, manufacturing jobs as people retire. So this need is really, really great. And again, we want to look at really short-term solutions,
right,
that we could start to implement today as other people are working on those longer-term infrastructure challenges.
Yeah, so while there might be good news in years coming depending on which side of things you're on, like, that might, there might be an expansion of the Metro Rail to the North Towns, which, of course, I could probably get a start a fire with that particular topic, right? But, you know, that's all sounds all well and good. But you're talking about right now there is a need. And, of course, back to, like you said, the wage earnings of people who do not have vehicles, you know, that is a daunting element. And poverty, of course, continues to be a lagging problem here in Western New York.
Yes. Yeah. Poverty certainly does continue to be in Western New York, and that includes, we do work in Niagara Falls, we do work in Jamestown, the major cities. It does continue to be a challenge, and really, if we want to attack this challenge, and we talk a lot about equity, and there's, again, lots of experts that do this for a living,
sure.
But I think about one of the ways to begin to address equity is to get individuals into good paying jobs, not just jobs, but careers with good pay and benefit where they can not just survive, but they can thrive and ultimately create generational wealth. So to me, that's really getting people is, we have large groups of people in our community that have not had the opportunity to gain generational type of wealth. I know people sometimes don't like that term wealth building, but that's right. The reality, just the ability to own a home and pass that down to the next generation. Even at that level, that's how you begin, I believe, to solve some of these challenges. And I know they're much more complex than I'm speaking to them.
But no, there's no doubt, though, again, an element, a subject matter that we've heard quite a bit about on this program is just that there's that lack of wealth or generational wealth, and unfortunately becomes, you know, generational poverty. Families, unfortunately, you know, find themselves, you know, kind of handing it on from generation to generation to a certain extent. Just back to the training opportunities, though. You're situated, Goodwill's situated with its Career Builders program to address both getting people who come out of out of poverty, and also providing the skills that they would need to maybe get some of these jobs, these advanced manufacturing jobs, for example.
Yes. Yeah, so the Good Skills Career Builder program came out of some research that we did when I was first at Goodwill in late 2020, early 2021. I came in May of 2020 in the middle of the pandemic, and we were shut down. Everything was shut down. One of the first things we did is went back to the University of Buffalo and said, could you help us do some research on what are going to be the needs of our community post-COVID-19, especially the needs of those people that maybe were in industries like travel, tourism, restaurant industries that were just devastated, healthcare industries. So what came out of that study that we did with the university was really this pre-pipeline work that we're doing. We identified there was a gap in the workforce development arena to identify people that were ready to go to work that did not have a college education, but that were prepared to enter the workforce. And we had employers on the other side that had entry-level jobs in these two areas, tech and manufacturing. The reason we focus there is because there's an upward career path. So we call those career builder jobs.
Okay. All right.
And those particular jobs over the course of a 20-year career can mean over $1.2 million to a family in new and additional income. So that's why we focus there again, was like, how do we not just talk about a job, but we start to talk about a career? So we're the very beginning. And when you go through our program, again, we give you workforce readiness skills. So we're not really training you to be an advanced manufacturer. We're training you to be successful in the workforce. And that's what employers want.
Okay.
Is employers want people that will show up on time, will communicate well, will learn, and they'll do the training. So after going through the beginning of our program, you may go on to additional training at someplace like Northland, for instance, right? So we work closely with them, where you might go on for a manufacturing degree of some type, or you may go to an employer. And what we found when we started the program is we thought mostly we'd be sending people to the next level of training.
Yes.
But over 95% of the individuals needed work now. They needed a job.
Okay.
So we are placing most people into jobs with companies.
Okay, that's obviously very encouraging. I mean, you said it, employers are looking for, and you said it the first thing, showing up on time. And it is hard to show up on time in Western New York. With the weather, it can be hard, even if you have a vehicle. But when you don't have a vehicle, it really does put a stress on things. And it's interesting, this brief that you put together has case studies taking a look at three different scenarios where, again, kind of building on real life scenarios that are tremendously complicated and have to be very, very difficult circumstances to move through.
Absolutely. I think the three case studies are very interesting because they're not real people, they're scenarios, but they're based on real challenges that we deal with and the individuals that we work with deal with every day. And I think what's most interesting, those of us that maybe have had a car for our entire lives,
right,
do not recognize the severity of some of these challenges, meaning, one of the examples in here is a gentleman, Landon, in Niagara Falls, who's offered a job at a manufacturer in Lockport.
Okay.
But to get there, the commute is like 2 hours and 15 minutes each way. And on top of that, it doesn't necessarily line up. The bus may not, or the transportation may not get you there at the right time to start your job, to your point, right? So in this instance, you may be sitting out in the parking lot, excuse me, for an hour in order to go to your job, and you may not be, you may have to wait later after your job to catch a bus back. So you add it up, and people can be in transportation for 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. One example we have in here, it's over 7 hours.
7 hours?
7 hours transportation back and forth between waiting and transportation. And, you know, as we talk about this at Goodwill with the team, we're always encouraging people to go to work. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, people don't want to go to work. But who would want to go to work, any of us,
right,
if you had to sit 7 hours to get from one place to another?
Right.
And then on top of that, you layer in other challenges like maybe coordinating. We have one example, Miranda, who is, you know, looking for interviewing for a job out in Gettysville, who lives in the city. Great bus transportation, but again, the schedules don't line up with her childcare. So her childcare, she's close to a bus stop. There's a bus stop close to the employer, but the childcare closes before she can get back to pick up her children. So again, there's another layer of challenges or barriers or obstacles that people face when they don't have their own transportation.
We are talking with Tom Ulbrich, the president and CEO of Goodwill of Western New York. Tom, if you need to take a drink right now, I know you're working through it. I understand what it's like to be in front of a microphone when you got a cough occasionally. But we're talking about the recent brief that takes a look at many of the challenges, especially transportation-related challenges here in Western New York. Interesting, though, also reaching out, we were talking about the employee side. Let's look at the employers, and it's interesting to see how many employers are also finding this, for lack of a better term, an exciting development. Obviously, it's not much, it's still a brief, it's still pieces of paper, but they seem to be responding to the need, both obviously from their own motivations, their own profit seeking, and trying to find solutions as well. So what you recently convened some of these employers. Let's talk about what you heard.
Yeah, sure. And the title of the brief actually is Expanding and Retaining Talent, Employer-Led Strategies for Transportation and a More Inclusive Workforce. So again, our goal here is to have employers lean in, and they're willing to lean in. Of course, they have, excuse me.
That's right.
Of course, they have their own needs, right? But they are challenged looking for people. And we did convene a group of employers, a group of workforce providers a couple weeks ago. And we had some of the largest companies in Western New York attend, some small businesses, and had an incredible discussion. Also had other people at the event that are doing some of this work out in the community already, trying to help solve some of these challenges. So we didn't want to be duplicative. We wanted, Goodwill looks at ourselves as a convener,
right,
and bringing together people. So for instance, GoBike was there, the Buffalo Niagara Partnership was there, bringing their work that they are and sharing it with the employers also. So it was very well received. We actually are planning on a follow-up event with some employers to test some possible solutions together,
okay,
to maybe make some investments and test some of the solutions that we came up with that are relatively inexpensive, I would say, but may have high potential return if we can work through them.
All right, well, let's maybe explore to some of those those opportunities. I mean, that sounds exciting for a lot of different reasons. So let's maybe get into some of them, especially the idea that it's maybe not all that expensive, which is...
Sure. So we've looked at a bunch of different things. We looked at transportation alternatives. We looked at financial incentives to help their employees. We looked at infrastructure support, and we looked at operational flexibility. So let's go with the last one first.
Okay.
And operational flexibility, where possible, is, I believe, actually some of the lowest hanging fruit. And that just meaning the ability to flex schedules when it's possible to get closer to times that meet individuals' needs based on existing schedules and bus schedules.
Like our case study before from the 7-hour commute, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Is there a way, is there a way that we could flex somebody? So the one case study in there of a young woman that we used, Miranda, with the tech job in Gettysville, that would have been simply if we could have flexed her job by about 30 minutes, it would have solved all of her problems. And she would have had a job and an employer would have had an employee. We would have had the perfect match, right, so to speak. I think another thing that we saw, and I'll just bring forth an example of Westerner Company, and that is Moog, that what they do is education of new employees. So sort of doing the research ahead of time for people and showing them some of the options that they may have for transportation and trying to address those problems in the hiring process. So that's what I would call, simple things that maybe you can do. And there's a great example of a company in Buffalo and Western New York that we highlight in the report called TapeCon, who is a small business, successful small business here in Buffalo. They're in Larkinville area. Same thing, challenge for individuals. And their president, Steve Davis, came up with a bunch of different things. So he gives dollars towards transportation as a benefit. Mm-hmm. So that's a tax deductible benefit that he gives to the employees each month. They do flex time where possible. They also coach employees as far as what are some of the alternatives that they may have to for options. So one of the things that came out of this report, often there's not a single solution.
Sure.
Right? It's a complex situation. It's looking at variable situations and solutions all at the same time. And then the final one we can talk about is, as we get back together, I think a interesting solution that's been tried by companies off and on would be this concept of a carpool or a van pool.
Okay.
So if we got a bunch of employers that were in an area where perhaps the bus stop didn't go far enough or wasn't frequent enough, if we could go from that last bus stop, the closest bus stop, and then pool together people and get them to their employers. So I think a good example that would be if you go out Walden Avenue.
Okay.
You get out, there's a lot of manufacturers out
Absolutely.
That way in Lancaster.
Yes.
There is bus service out that way, but it's the frequency does Right. not maybe align. So if we could get a bunch of employers together and set up a van pool where we all contributed to that at some level and got those people sort of that last few miles to their job, that would suddenly open up many, many more jobs in the area. And what's interesting, I think, about this report in the Buffalo Niagara region, so the difference between having a car and not having a car, you would have access to employers. Now, this is let's talk about the benefit to employers.
Sure.
If people had their transportation problem solved, the report shows they would have access to over almost 19,000 more employees that Wow. are being held back because of the inability to travel properly. So it doesn't mean they have to have a car, but if we can help solve some of these transportation challenges.
And just to add to that, then if 19,000 more people were employed and 19,000 more people were bringing home regular paychecks, what that would mean for the Western New York economy is really interesting.
It's massive. And also what it means for the employer. So, national data shows that it costs an employer about $5,300 to replace an individual. So that's not lost productivity. That's just the expense of, putting up the ads, doing the interviewing,
onboarding,
all those pieces. So if you can imagine, add now on if you don't have if you're missing people and you don't have productivity, that's a significant cost to businesses. So another thing we're encouraging business to do is to do that math and to say, okay, if I invest $30,000 in a van to vanpool people, and I'm able to bring, you know, my call-off rate down from, say, 37% to 27%, what does that mean financially to us operationally, that we're able to be more productive, our machines are working? And it can mean hundreds of thousands of dollars for a small company, which quickly can offset the cost of the, you know, experiment, so to speak, of trying to get people to work.
Right. And I think it's obviously, to a certain extent, a silly question, but it's always worth mentioning. Are employers also maybe thinking, maybe we should move to where the population is?
That is an interesting question. And I think, you know, I think a lot about Northland and where Northland is situated,
right,
and the purposeful, you know, the purpose-driven, let's place this training center in the heart of the East Side where the people that need the jobs are.
Right.
I can't help but imagine, excuse me, yes, again, I can't help but imagine what that might look like if manufacturers took those brownfields around there and actually placed buildings down there. Yeah. I think there's a lot more complication.
Of course.
You know, this, it's a complicated discussion, yes, I'm sure, but it is an interesting thing if we were to able to place facilities in the communities. That would be another way to solve the problem, but it's probably much more complicated with land ownership and investment,
right,
and all the different pieces that come with it.
Yeah, most certainly can understand it. And you know, as you mentioned, the Walden Avenue facilities are quite massive out in the eastern part of Erie County. Yeah. So that's another issue, obviously. But it's an interesting part of this whole kind of conversation that we're having here. We're talking with Tom Ulbrich, President and CEO of Goodwill of Western New York, on What's Next this morning. Well, we haven't really spent a lot of time talking about the people you do train. Let's maybe get into that just a little bit, and how that works. You know, because as we talked about before we went on the air, you know, Goodwill has pivoted in recent years from what had been a kind of a traditional image of Goodwill, sheltered workshops for labor. That is not the case anymore.
Yeah. So a large history of Goodwill was serving people with disabilities, and you know, We're very proud of that history. It did great work in the community. That work came to an end based on some new rules in New York State about sheltered workshops and them needing to be unsheltered. And the board had decided that there were other people in the community that did great work like that, like People Inc., Cantillation Center, other organizations that did that kind of work well. And that we would pivot. So this is how we've pivoted, is into this training. So we're serving, most of the people we serve do not need to be, but about 75% of the individuals that we serve are from inner city communities.
Okay.
We have a large focus in the east side of Buffalo. And the early statistics in the pilot year of the program, you know, the board actually challenged me to say, you're training for advanced manufacturing and for tech. Are you focused on serving the individuals that Goodwill is really here to help?
Right.
Excuse me again. So we did some research on that. And the pilot year of the program, 98% of individuals utilize a safety net program coming into to our Good Skills program. 81% of them resided in a high poverty zip code. 75% were individuals of color, and 72% were actually unemployed. And I can go on. We, you know, 20% were justice involved. So we are absolutely serving part of Western New York's community that needs these opportunities. And the difference, again, was that we talked about earlier, is our research showed there was this gap, as you said, where companies have jobs, good jobs. Individuals want work, but I think a lot of people thought advanced manufacturing and tech meant college degrees, and many of those jobs do mean college degrees, but both those industries have lots of entry-level jobs where you do not need a college education. You do need a GED or a high school diploma.
Sure.
if you're willing to go in at an entry level and train up, and then they have a pathway up internally in the companies. And that's really, and again, and we call that
career building. You're seeing lots of those opportunities.
We are seeing lots of those opportunities. So to date, we've graduated almost 500 people, over 500 people through the program.
Okay.
And over 300 of those have been placed in jobs.
Wow.
So that, you know, again, it's not a perfect success rate, but for workforce development, that's pretty good. And we're seeing individuals be successful, and we continue to learn more. And as we learn, we pivot the program, develop the program, and continue to do that. But we're really, really focused there.
And we, you know, we obviously came in to talk about the Career Builders brief, but another interesting part, just to keep this in mind about Goodwill, there are Goodwill stores around Western New York, and yes, these are key to this whole program.
Absolutely. And one of the challenges when I was first recruited to come to Goodwill by a headhunter, when I got the calls, I was, no, I'm not interested in running a bunch of retail stores. So many people don't know what Goodwill is and what Goodwill does. And we're trying to, this is a great opportunity, so thank you for having us.
Pleasure.
Get that information out there. Our retail stores are only a means to fund our workforce development program. So in the community, your generous donations, when you donate them to Goodwill, we turn them into dollars. So we're not a charity in the sense that we're giving away clothes. We're actually trying to maximize the donor value, or the value of that donation that you give us, and generate the largest profit we can while being reasonable within a thrift store reality, and then taking that profit and putting it back towards our workforce development programs. So the retail is critical, and it's really a social innovation model that we're really working hard on. And our goal is by 2030 to self-fund 90% of all Goodwill workforce development and overhead. So less than 10% of our work should be coming from outside dollars. And my goal would be at that time that 10% would probably be innovation money. You know, we would maybe get a grant to innovate and try something new. But we're well on our way to doing that. Thank you, Buffalo. Thank you, Western New York.
Right.
We've grown the stores over 240%.
Wow.
In the past, since the end of 2020, and continuing that growth. And we're just getting ready to start to open. Over the next few years, we'll be opening the other part of our market, which would be that southwestern part, so Jamestown, Olean, Fredonia. We have the territory all the way up to the Pennsylvania line,
okay,
moving over towards Erie. And that will get us to, our goal is $30 million by 2030, which we are well on the way to doing that at this point.
Wow.
And I'm fairly confident that we've built an incredible team. And, you know, the people we have at Goodwill that, you know, our 240 employees every day get up living this mission. And I am very confident in the team that we're going to get there. And also, I do want to retire. So that's sort of my tipping point is
nice.
is helping us get to that point.
And then finally, Tom, obviously, we came in here to talk about, you know, connecting the possibilities of people with jobs with employers. It sounds like you've done a great job of connecting with employers, but you never know. There could be somebody listening right now that might want to find out a little bit more. What should they do?
Sure. We are always happy to speak to employers to see if it's a good match. As I said earlier, we want employers and we need employers to be equal partners at the table so that we're creating training programs for the problems or the jobs that the companies have, right? So if anybody is interested, whether it's in the program, you can just go on our website, goodwillwny.org. You can find us in the phone book, but just reach out to us. There's lots of ways to do that. And we will be happy to connect you to the right people and explore how we might work together. Or if you're an individual hearing this or have a child, a grandchild that you think there's a great opportunity for training at Goodwill, please connect them to us and we will help them on their career journey, hopefully.
Wow. Tom, great stuff. I really appreciate the insight, and thanks for being with us on What's Next.
And thank you so much for having Goodwill. We appreciate you.
Tom Ulbrich is president and CEO of Goodwill of Western New York. Stay with us on What's Next. Coming up, we'll hear from Alex Simone talking with youth members about climate issues. This is What's Next on WBFO.
You're listening to What's Next our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. If you have a story or concern that we should be addressing, email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back to What's Next, and I'm Alex Simone. Today, we're sitting down with some local climate activists to discuss a court case involving the Kensington Expressway and more. I'm joined by Valerie Wong, a member of the Youth Climate Council, Jamal Davis, a transit rider organizer for the Coalition of Economic Justice, and Dan Brady, an attorney with Hagerty and Brady, who is involved with both groups. And what is it about this court case that you guys are involved with that you think stands apart from others involving the Kensington, Kensington Expressway? And what do you think, like, kind of puts you, gives you a bit better chance with that?
I will take a stab at that one. I'll say I don't necessarily think our case has a better or worse chance than any of the other cases that are going forward. What does make our case a little bit distinct from there are three New York State lawsuits brought regarding the Kensington Expressway. What does make our case a little bit distinct is ours is solely focused on the climate effects of these transportation decisions. And so we are really focused on the greenhouse gas emissions that are forecasted to be produced by this project, and particularly interested in what we allege to be basically a complete failure on the behalf of the Department of Transportation to do any kind of planning that would result in reductions of greenhouse gas emissions, which would allow us to meet our greenhouse gas emission reductions that are enshrined into law in the Climate and Leadership Protection Act, but are also what the global scientific consensus tells us we need to do in order to avert the worst effects of climate change. So our proceeding is a little bit on different footing than the other ones, mostly because we are kind of laser focused on the climate effects of this project.
And one of the things I've heard about is that the, pollution implications, right, with the expressway versus the, you know, the proposed tunnel, right? And there's a little bit of a difference as far as how that pollution and those greenhouse gases might be dispersed, right? So could you maybe go a little bit into maybe the difference in concerns that you all would have between those two, with having the possibility of a tunnel versus, again, the expressway that's there now?
Absolutely. So the end goal would be to remove all of this pollution by reducing vehicle miles traveled to begin with. But in terms of the difference between the tunnel and the expressway as it is now, would be the fact that the tunnel does not incorporate filtration, which is something that was talked about earlier in negotiations but was ultimately scrapped. And what that means is that at each end of the tunnel, there's going to be a high degree of concentrated and dangerous pollution that the community is going to have health effects from, especially considering that the community already has health effects, even without that extra concentration of pollution, which is not something we necessarily need a study to understand is a point of concern for, but should merit its own research in order to understand how that might affect the community and why this tunnel is ultimately not in line with the state's goals through the CLCPA, through the emissions lens, or through the just transition lens of ensuring the health of communities, especially the disadvantaged community that this project is going to hopefully not take place in.
And when you're talking to residents and getting their thoughts, were there any, like, maybe proposed solutions on their parts, you know, or thoughts that they had, their input that was kind of, you know, surprising, maybe a different perspective than you guys were thinking of, or, you know, maybe different priorities, and it's like, oh,
that hadn't occurred to me as much, you know, that kind of thing. Anything you could maybe clue us in on?
Yeah, so the organization that largely works with engaging the local community would be the Eastside Parkways Coalition, who is leading multiple lawsuits themselves against the state as well as the federal government. And some of these solutions that they put forward in collaboration with their plaintiffs, they have over 60 for one of their cases, who live in the local area and do not want this highway tunnel project, would be highway removal, park restoration, and more than just highway removal and parkway restoration, they are looking to push for a complete streets model, which essentially means that there would be a multi-mobility option. So there would be bike lanes, there would be public transportation, there would also still be room for cars, but ultimately we know that vehicle miles traveled will be reduced if you have those complete street options for biking, for walking, and for public transportation. That is a lot of what they've been talking about with local residents. And does that kind of answer your question?
I think so. Yeah.
But also the residents, you know, they also understand that this is an opportunity for change, right? We're not going to pretend like that that's not there. And, you know, by building a model based off of what Valerie so eloquently stated, it gives them the opportunity for the community to grow, to be more equitable, to find and develop more opportunities to where they can, you know, provide safer communities and safer streets. So this model isn't just, you know, something that is, you know, based off of the law, which we see it clearly violates or our ambitions to make sure we make a cleaner, safe community for our future. But it's about understanding that the opportunity and the time is now. And we need, and we're standing up now to make sure that we're here to make sure that something gets done about that.
And along the lines of, you know, I guess those interactions, and when it comes to the aftermath, I mean, even if it's a tunnel, right, that's put in there, again, I understand that's not what a lot of people would prefer, but even if it does end up being a tunnel, that's still, I feel like, the removal of a literal barrier between communities, right? The expressway is literally a barrier between the east and the west side of Buffalo. And, you know, could you maybe go a little into just the significance of something that, I guess, massive, right? And you know, such a wall of sorts coming down from between the two areas.
That is a great question. And to be upfront, the 33 kind of just runs through the east side. It doesn't really connect to the west side. It ends at downtown Buffalo. So that when they talk about connecting communities, they're talking about the healing of the east side, right? So humbly, being a resident from there, I wouldn't eloquently state it that way. I would say that, you know, our community was ravaged for, you know, the capital gain of individuals who came from outside of the community to make it an easier commute for them. Humbly and respectfully, that was a park that my mother grew up at, and, you know, I hear beautiful, wonderful stories just about how, you know, it gave us opportunity to come together. Now, as I previously stated, this is an opportunity. So this opportunity now, the tunnel, the way it was presented, it was more like a reconnecting communities. You guys can come back together. We can, you know, paint some wild lives. You guys are, you know, be able to heal in some ways. And it was the Band-Aid approach doesn't feel comfortable. It's not something that, you know, you can adequately state in the amount of time that we have, because it would get into like the emotions of like the community. But I would say, as a person, as a member from the community, imagine, you know, the emissions of those gases coming out onto that community from a tunnel. I am primarily close to someone who is a representative of this complaint, who lives right off that expressway, and is concerned about the lifestyle of which, how she's going to breathe, how she's going to grow, how she's going to be able to live and sustain while this is happening, while construction is happening, and what's going to happen to her in the present day. So I try to stay out of the past of what it, you know, what it did, what had happened, and what it could be, because I'm concerned about what's happening now.
Absolutely. So tying this back into our lawsuit that is based on the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, a big reason why youth are so disproportionately affected are because they are going to be the community that we are to protect going forward. Right. And going back to how reconnecting this community may impact this community, I am someone who does not live on the East Side, but I did refer one of my good friends to become a plaintiff on the East Side Parkways Coalition's lawsuit. And having spoken to local residents while tabling, their perspective is largely that reconnecting the community is a positive thing because we want strong, healthy communities. Putting high concentrations of dangerous pollution into this community does not make a strong, healthy community. Yes, we want this community to be reconnected, but not at the cost of being able to genuinely build strong, healthy communities.
And to follow up on that, I guess, Valerie, is there anything about maybe the Youth Climate Council perspective that is kind of, I guess, unique that you think, your group brings to the table? 'Cause again, there are a lot of people advocating for change. What do you think it is that you all bring to the table that's different, maybe a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are some things that are different. I think there are some things that are very much the same at the national level, considering that there have been a number of youth climate lawsuits in recent years. For example, in 2022, Navajin v. Hawaii DOT demanded that the state meet its carbon zero transportation standard by 2045, resulting in the first constitutional climate settlement of its kind in the world just earlier this year. There was also 2023 Held v. Montana, which determined that Montana must consider climate change impacts when approving fossil fuel projects based on the right to a clean and healthful environment in Montana's state law constitution. Right now is really a time for youth climate organizing, as it has always needed to be. And I think a big part of that comes down to that aspect of self-determination. Because youth are the ones who are inheriting this planet and are going to be making up the communities of our future, it is so important that youth have self-determination. And I think that ties back into why we want the local community to really lead about what they want in terms of the climate projects in their area, as outlined by the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act standards in terms of the just transition aspect. So I really think emphasizing that self-determination aspect is what makes the youth climate, especially youth climate justice movement, so compelling. And I hope that the Youth Climate Council here can help bring that to the forefront.
And, again, so from the standpoint of, you, Jamal, with, climate justice and, again, in the Youth Climate Council, environmental justice.
Coalition for Economic Justice.
Thank you.
It's a lot of acronyms all the way around.
So with this collaboration going on, right? I'm so interested in how that can change the dynamic of things, because so often it feels like when there are groups who want to see change, I feel like I look at, and a lot of the times it seems like groups are kind of working parallel to each other, right? And it can be tough to really get that where, you're working together, maybe logistically or for, other reasons, but to actually be, reach the point where it's like, okay, we're collaborating on this effort. What do you think that has done as far as changing things, maybe changing the resources or stuff like that?
In the community, as a whole, because this is one specific project. Like I said, I work for the CEJ, where the campaign that I work on, we work on multiple projects. So the CEJ is also involved in the Clean Mobility Project, which focuses on the East Side as well as a result of the 514 massacre, which we all know, which is very difficult. But this project specifically works on in what ways the community can be actively involved in planning transportation, temporary transportation projects without their own community, kind of give the power back. The NYSERDA awarded the East Side a $10 million grant, which brings in multiple community partners. I was actually here a few weeks ago having this conversation with one of our community partners, Go Bike. NFTA is a community partner, Open Buffalo. It has been very refreshing that we got to come together and be creative and develop, well, at least temporary solutions on how we can impact the community today. It has been so refreshing, and just from my perspective at CEJ, we really appreciate our community partners. The list is very long, and so if I went into them, it'd be more acronyms and it'd sound crazy, so I'm not going to do that, but I do want to say to all of our community partners, we appreciate you, and let's keep it going.
Absolutely. I think that's something that's really special about climate justice to begin with, because it's something that is so comprehensive and requires that type of interdependence between community organizers and community campaigns. It's just something that really leads to very complete solutions that truly center the community and our climate. I think that's what's really special about climate justice, and in this partnership that I have with Coalition for Economic Justice, as well as Citizens for Regional Transit, and our lawyer, Dan, who on a whim decided to come work with us, which I thought was really awesome. So thank you so much for that, Dan. Absolutely. We wouldn't be here if it weren't for you.
Yeah, that's facts.
Well, that's much appreciated. Well, hopefully we can get a good result. But I did want to point out, and to echo with these but these guys have said that the partnership has been really impressive, and I think these are organizations, Citizens for Regional Transit, Coalition for Economic Justice, and the West New York Youth Climate Council, that I don't believe had much in terms of, you know, working alongside each other before this, and so it's been fun to kind of see that relationship blossom. And you know, one of the things that I've been struck by in this process, and I continue to be struck by, this is obviously a big project, and there are a lot of strong emotions on kind of all sides of it. And, you know, those emotions are valid. You know, some people really, something is finally going to happen, and now here's a lawsuit that's seeking to stop it. I understand why people would feel strongly about that, and it's a valid response. One of the things I've been struck by is the bravery of a lot of these petitioners who've come forward to bring this lawsuit, to hold the state accountable and say, hey, you know, we passed this climate law and you guys need to follow it. You know, if you look at the Western New York Youth Climate Council, these are college and high school kids. Valerie is at the University of Buffalo. We have another petitioner who put in an affidavit, Felix Hatton, who's a junior at City Honors.
I believe so. It's a little hard to remember since he's been with us since I think he was actually in middle school.
Yeah. and another organizer from West New York Youth Climate Council who's proceeding under a pseudonym is a freshman in high school at a West New York high school.
Just about, yeah.
And so I've been kind of taken aback by the willingness of these kids to get involved in this fight when emotions are high and a lot of adults and a lot of leaders in the community aren't really willing to get involved in this fight because they don't really want to potentially get themselves involved in a fight. But these kids are basically willing to stand up and say, hey, no, you know, this is our future, and you know, we demand that the state follow its own law.
So I'm also interested then from hearing what Valerie said about you getting involved in this, Dan. It sounds almost like you were maybe the one who initiated that contact with the. Is that? Am I reading into that too much, or is that?
It's all a bit of a blur, Alex.
that's where I come in. I have no problem. This guy has been great. As an individual, I've stated multiple times, being from the community, also being an organizer in the community, it was so refreshing to see someone impacted who may not be a part of the community come in and genuinely put the time, the effort, the energy to first understand, because Dan wasn't quite familiar with the CLCPA prior to doing this. So, I mean, just figuring, just learning policy and understanding what are the effects before he even reached out to anyone. And then when he gathered us, he listened to us. He didn't want to come and tell us what he was going to do. He listened to us. And then and making like the priority, the YCC, I'm sorry, I'm just going to use your acronym, but the YCC there as a priority for this action, I felt compelled as an organizer, a person of the community, to support it, because it was like, that's the type of route that we would need that would bring forth tangible change. With that word tangible there, tangible change. And Dan has been a true advocate, a true a warrior from a different community. But he's connected and he's been great, and we really appreciate him. Really appreciate him.
Thanks, Jamal. That's maybe an overstatement, but I'll take it.
That's what you're supposed to do. Take it. He's supposed to do.
Are there any challenges, I guess, you see with... of course, I understand there, yeah, innumerable challenges as far as getting this done. But, as far as maybe... Once it were to, right, let's say a parkway does get, or the project gets started, right, to put a parkway in place. And, maybe what are some of the challenges you see once that process starts, or once that process maybe is, closer to completion in, let's say, a few years' time, or, in 10 years' time, maybe?
Yeah, so something that I would add that other community members have already discussed is the need for a community benefits agreement no matter what goes forward. The community that is there where the project is going to happen, whatever project that might be, needs to be centered in making sure that they are the ones who genuinely receive the economic benefits, which I'm sure Jamal can speak more to. And something that is more in the future that I would discuss would be how they govern whatever project is going to be built. How do you ensure that you have ongoing capacity, not just to maintain whatever project it is, but to also make sure that the economic benefits of that maintenance is going to be just?
Couldn't say it any better than that.
Oh, thank you, Jamal.
As far as the, what exactly you want to see here, what to do with this space, right? I feel like it's one of those, it's such a big space, right? That, probably seeing one thing, size of scale of parkways and that kind of things. But I would feel like that would be a massive parkway. So, is it one of those you think where maybe there are some different, a few things you want to see done with that space, or just to inject your own personal, goals for the area, maybe beautification, that kind of thing.
As far as the aesthetics, obviously, as a person who's grown up hearing stories about the original Humboldt Park, and I mean, to this day, I'm blessed to say that my family meets on Zoom every week for Bible study, to where it's still reinforced. I would want to imagine something that would have something of that element, to where that culture that it was cultivated and developed there is sustained. But also, as Valerie so eloquently stated, what is the economic impact and what ways we can develop it for the future and keep it moving forward. Now, me as a community member, I wear too many hats to come up with one specific idea. So I would turn it over to individuals like my friends here who have been very, very powerful advocates for the community. To help us determine what some creative ideas could look like.
Thank you. I appreciate that. but going back to something you did mention briefly about trying to maintain the culture of the community that has been built up, I recently learned this really interesting phrase called cultural displacement that often happens during turbulent changes such as building a expressway through a neighborhood where the whole geography of the community literally changes and therefore changes the social and communal aspects of that community rather than just the physical environmental ones. So the example that I was given when this concept was explained to me was that if there was a corner shop that used to be a cafe that had to be taken out for whatever sort of economic downturn, it might be nice to put another place in that same old coffee store location that people can also hang out at, because that kind of maintains the rhythm of that community and how they community build. So as someone who doesn't live in that community, I will keep my, you know, aspirations loose. Like I said, I believe in self-determination. That's not me determination of other communities, but I'll keep it pretty general. I think areas to community build would be really, really important, because that's crucial for strong communities. I think being able to, as a youth organizer, of course, I'm motivated to say this, have areas that allow for communal childcare, right? For example, if they're maybe not like a playground, but somewhere that's designated where it's safe for kids to play and to experience happy childhood with, you know, nature around, because it's good for you. Things like that, I think you will see come out as points of interest for local community members who want to see something different.
And that will do it for this episode of What's Next. I want to thank my guests, Valerie Wong, Jamal Davis, and Dan Brady. This has been What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.